Harnack felt that investigating the nuts and bolts cases would best prove most helpful in convincing the scientific community that UFOs were worthy of consideration as a legitimate phenomenon. Candidly, in a number of conversations, however, he professed an avid interest in the more bizarre aspects of this intriguing subject. As his research took him further and further, he became convinced that some of the hair-raising tales told by witnesses might, indeed, have a degree of basis in reality. In an article published some years ago in Playboy, Harnack admitted that he was genuinely puzzled by the stories often told by witnesses of their phone being tapped, or of being watched, sometimes on a regular basis, either by the government or by the occupants of the craft themselves. Harnack told the author of this book in an interview that he considered the MIB to be a mighty big puzzle, mainly because those experiences are damn hard to relate to. Reclining in his chair to get more comfortable, the astronomer started to relate several puzzling stories involving the UFO silencers, stories that he had run into personally during the course of his research. This is what he had to say. The most recent Men in Black case I am familiar with concerns Carlos Motil, the young man whose plane was flying near Mexico City in May of 1976. Several weeks after his encounter, the witness was supposed to appear on a TV show in Mexico to talk about what had happened. He never showed up at the studio. Carlos Motil later claimed that his car had been forced off the road while he was driving to the station. A strange-looking man dressed in black clothing approached him and said it would be wise if he did not go on the show. The following Saturday, I interviewed him for 2 hours in my hotel room. As we concluded our conversation, Carlos promised to have breakfast with me on Monday morning. Again, he pulled a no-show routine. Over the telephone that afternoon, he explained how the same individual in black had again requested he not meet with me. It was a better not or else sort of veiled threat. As for an explanation, we really don't know what the nature of these silencers might be. It seems to belong, in many cases, in the category of a psychic occurrence, as some of these men in black seem to be able to read the minds of witnesses, thus knowing what course of action they plan to take following their UFO encounter. Again, you're seeking answers and all I can give you is a problem. But Harnack was not finished relating what he knew about the MIB as he continued on to tell us another tale. Now I'll tell you a whopper. Someone called the center's hotline in the middle of the night and got me out of bed. It was a police officer from a small town in Minnesota, where a localized flap had been going on since November, 1975. What he told me seems to fit in with these paranormal elements. It seems that a couple was riding down a highway toward town, when the man remembered he had to make a phone call. He swung his car into the driveway of a motel and proceeded to walk toward an outdoor phone booth. Just as he was about to open the door to the booth, a big black Cadillac pulled up in front of him, blocking his path. A man hopped out of the front seat and literally pushed the gentleman out of the way in an effort to get to the phone first. Miffed by this uncourteous action, the man drove down the highway until he came to a second roadside telephone. This time the mysterious black car nearly drove the fellow and his wife into a ditch. They narrowly escaped injury. As before, the big caddy came to a screeching halt, the front door flew open and out raced the same individual. His destination was the telephone. He just about took the dime out of my hand, was the way he reported the incident. The story is not over. According to the police officer who called me, the identical format was followed a third time. By now the couple was burning mad. They chased the car down the highway trying to copy down the license plate number, which they were successful in doing. Suddenly, and this is where the whole episode gets eerie, before their eyes, the vehicle in front of them lifted up into the air and disappeared as if it had flown into another dimension. Immediately, the confused couple contacted the police. The investigating officer, the lawman who called me, said his department verified the fact that this particular license plate number had been issued to a gentleman residing in a nearby town. When questioned, this individual refused to say whether or not he was involved in the episode. Eventually, the officer impressed him with the fact that he might be charged with reckless driving if he didn't come clean. With this, The man stated that he was a Jehovah's Witness and therefore could not tell a lie. The outcome was that he did not see the episode as a UFO experience but accepted it in the context of his religion. Normally he wouldn't bother to investigate this sort of thing, but somehow it just seems to fit in. I know there are many unanswered questions here, but we will just have to leave it as a cliffhanger until a later date. Christa Tilton's personal MIB encounters. In UFO circles today, Christa Tilton has become a key figure. This is due to her claims of having been abducted and examined by aliens, as well as possibly having been impregnated by another worldly force. Her story is a long and sometimes complex one, involving trips to an underground UFO base with its many levels and weird genetic experimentation which she observed while being escorted around by an alien guide. In May, indeed, seem like UFOs and ETs have attached themselves to this blonde-haired UFO percipient like a hive full of bees would to honey. The truth is, Christa can talk for hours about the things that have happened to her, things often so bizarre and out of place that it becomes difficult to categorize them at all properly. Currently, Christa is busy working on a book about her experience, so it promises to be a doozy. And edits a journal called Crux, Box 906237, Tulsa, Oklahoma 74112, in which she keeps others posted on her UFO-related activities, as well as the stories of others which seem to confirm her tales of extraterrestrial intrigue. As might be expected from this brief introduction, Christa has not gone unnoticed by the MIB. They have managed to keep tabs on her, to the point where she was nearly run off the road at least once. But, it's best if we let Christa go into the details herself, as she tells them so much better and concisely than anyone else possibly could. In May of 1987, I was attending Tulsa Junior College. I had been accepted for a nursing course, but I had some prerequisite courses that I still had to take. I was taking an American history course at the South Campus, which is in a semi-rural, somewhat isolated area. I should explain that at around this time several things were occurring in my life. I had begun seeing a person in Tulsa who was trying to help me come to grips with and acknowledge the fact that I was having abduction experiences. I was having problems, including sleeping. I had been taking this night class in history at the South Campus, plus another class in pathogenic microbiology at the downtown campus. There were only two classes being taught at the South Campus the nights I attended. There was a psychology class next to our class, and those were the only two on that basement floor. There were about 25 students in my class. I felt a little uncomfortable in that I was in my 30s and most everyone else was much younger. So I befriended a Pakistani woman in her late 30s. She and her husband had come to the United States and were getting their citizenship, and she was going through the same nursing program as I. So we exchanged phone numbers so we could share notes and use a buddy system of studying. One evening in May of 1987, while I was still taking history class, something happened to me at the South Campus. This evening we were to take a difficult exam on the Civil War, and not my thing. I was out in the hall cramming for this history exam with my book open and notes in hand. Everyone was either sitting in the classroom or standing there in the hall. I remember seeing my teacher coming down the hall. He commented, "You'd better be ready for this test." "I am," I told him, trying not to look him in the eye. By then it was obvious to me that no matter how hard I studied, I just couldn't keep my mind on the answers. I noticed people were gathering for the psychology class next door. I was leaning up against the wall when someone tapped me on the shoulder. I turned around and there was the most unusual person I'd ever seen. He was tall and lanky and very scary looking. He was wearing a dark brown suit. My grandfather used to wear one just like that. My first thought was, gee, how old-fashioned. The pants did not fit right. They came up too high on his ankles. He was wearing a thin black tie and a starched white shirt. He had oriental-type features. I tried to pinpoint whether he was Japanese, Korean or what. His skin was olive colored and it looked like he was wearing makeup to make his face look lighter. He appeared to be wearing eyeliner on his eyes, to accentuate his eyes. I do not know if he was trying to make them look larger or smaller. This person had powder all over his face. He had black hair, smeared back with greasy brile cream stuff. It reminded me of a greasy monkey. Also, his lips appeared to be reddened in some way. This fellow was my worst nightmare. I looked forward to going back to Boynton Canyon, which is considered to be one of the vortex areas around Sedona. It's considered to be electromagnetic in nature. Some people go there and feel charged or energized, but it makes me feel very peaceful, very calm. When we arrived, my friend Barbara decided to take one of the trails up in the canyon. She wanted to go up Cayo where it was sunny. I am allergic to sunlight, so I told her I would go and sit under this tree by the road. I was only 15-20 feet from the paved road. I laid my blanket out and sat down to listen to my tapes that always calm me when some other hikers went by. I remember Barbara reiterating that I shouldn't leave without her. I wondered why she would even consider that possibility. Just as I settled down, I heard a car engine on the paved road. My back was to the road. I realized that after many seconds had elapsed, the driver of the car was not planning on turning the engine off. So I turned around. What I saw was the weirdest black car I had ever seen. I have never seen one like it. It reminded me of a car a queen would ride in. It was so shiny black that you could see my reflection in it. Everything about this car was black. It was an older model of limousine, but not a stretch limo. The glass was completely black. The tires were black, no white walls. The car was a four-door. The back right-hand door opened and there was a man sitting in the back seat. He had sunglasses on and his hair was black and combed back. Instead of getting out of the car, he just sat there looking straight ahead. All of a sudden his head turned to the right and he looked at me. He stuck his arm out and motioned for me to follow them. His head turned around, almost robotically, and then the door just shut on its own without his reaching to shut it. From what I could see, it looked like everything in the back seat was black also. I had my camera around my neck and I felt like, this is it. I have to go and see what they wanted. I definitely felt this had something to do with my abduction experiences. Maybe they placed that idea in my mind, but I don't know. I then screamed for Barbara to come and she yelled back for me to go on but to come back and pick her up in a few minutes. I then jumped into my own car, placed a tape in the recorder and pulled onto the road. The black car had driven to my right, which leads to a private compound at a dead end. There was a guard station at the gate. I figured it was some type of retirement community, but the guard was wearing olive green. He looked military to me. He motioned for me to stop. I asked him where the black limo went. He said, "Lady, I don't know what you are talking about. I never saw any car like that." I knew the car had to have been seen because it would have been stopped by the same guard. Anyway, that scared me, so I turned the car around and decided to drive down about a mile to where there was a fork in the road. The road to the right was a dirt road that leads to the center of the canyon. The paved road leads back into town. As I was driving, I was thinking that they probably passed me when I was calling to Barbara. Just at that moment, I reached the fork in the road and there was the black car. It was facing the right towards the dirt road. Something told me not to drive up too close because I thought they were going to rape me. That is exactly what went through my mind. So I rolled up my window, but left just a crack so I could breathe. It was very hot and the sweat was running down my whole body. I suddenly was riddled with fear. About that time I saw the same back door open up like before. This time I had a little different view into the car as I was sitting slightly back to the right rear of them, not exactly side by side. I could definitely see that there was a driver and another man in the back. They all looked the same, ear dark haired. They were all wearing the same type of sunglasses. Their skin looked almost like concrete. They were expressionless. After sitting for a while, it was obvious this guy wasn't getting out and I wasn't about to get out, so I just waited. I rolled my window down a couple of inches more and he turned his head to the side and said something like, "The time is all wrong." Then he rambled something about the topography of the area, about it not being suitable. I thought, now wait a minute. These guys must be part of them, and I gathered what he was telling me was that their craft was unable to land in that area. I wanted to ask him a question, when suddenly the back door closed and I would say they took off in a flash, because dirt was flying up everywhere. They drove off down the old narrow dirt road. I realized I had my camera around my neck. I said to myself, "You dummy, you had a chance to get a photo of that car." So I floored the car and followed after them. As I got up close to them, I grabbed my Canon and aimed. I was ready to feel that click when suddenly I felt nothing. It had gone dead. I tried the shutter again, but to no avail. I stopped the car long enough to examine the camera. It said I was out of film. What was really strange was I had plenty of film left in the camera when we left to go to the canyon. Now there was none. So despondent I was that I decided to drive back and get Bob. She was standing by the trail sign with her blanket in hand. You have to understand something about Barbara, she is not afraid of anything. She's rock solid. She has been my guide, a source of light in my life. She helped give me courage when other people would not. I got her in the car and immediately asked her if she had seen the big black car. She said she hadn't. I then began to explain this strange story to her. Then she said, "Christ, you are just letting your imagination run away with you." She told me to put it out of my mind and for us to continue our trip. It seemed strange that she had been so open to my experiences before, and now it seemed like she was brushing this off to imagination. I then drove on down to the fork in the road, when suddenly I turned the car to the right and went down the old dirt road. Suddenly, Barbara got real panicked. Now, as I have stated before, she is really strong, she just doesn't get like this. She said, "Please stop this car. Let's get out of here now." I asked her what was wrong, and she said, "I do not want to be in this area." She wanted to leave that area immediately. I wanted to go just a bit further to see if I could find that car and prove to her it did exist. Then we came up to a clearing, surrounded by trees. There was a big circle of dirt and I said, "This is where they landed. This is what is so weird, it's almost as if something told me to drive around this circle." I began to drive around, and then Barbara panicked and screamed, "Let's get the hell out of here now." Well, first of all, she doesn't use that type of language. Secondly, she doesn't panic. But I could tell she was very scared of what I didn't know. So I turned the car around, and once we reached the paved highway, her personality completely changed. It was like nothing had happened and everything was just fine. We did not even discuss it after that. I thought this was also very strange. It was as if this area was having an effect on her and myself. I began to really wonder if the black car was just a projection designed just for me to experience. It raised a lot of dust for a projection. And since the guard said he hadn't seen the car, where did it go? How did it turn around without the guard seeing it? I don't know if it was real, paranormal, imagined, or a projection, but it seemed real to me. My next experience took place around late August of 1987.1. Had been invited to stay at an investigator's home and take care of it while he was away. I did move in there, and it was that next week that I began to receive harassing phone calls. Anyway, I was driving during the day along Davis Mountain Air Force Base in Tucson, near the main gate. There are a series of underpasses that you go under, and I was driving along in my aunt's car, when all of a sudden, from out of nowhere, there was this big black car, not a limo like the one in Sedona, but a big black Lincoln. It was staying parallel to me. Again, they had a shaded windshield, but it was slightly tinted. It was not as black as the other car. I realized something funny was going on. And just about then the car inched over into my lane and bumped the side of my car. I swerved over to my right and slammed the brakes on. I was so shaken and scared. I watched them pull over into the right lane ahead of me and they stopped their car. It was as if they were waiting for me to come back along. I was going to have to pass them to get back, because I couldn't turn around. I felt they were trying to harass me, even threaten my life. But then I thought if they had really wanted to hurt me, they would have slammed harder into the side of the car. I did not get out of the car to check for any damage. I was afraid. I thought to myself, why don't I have any mace with me or a billy club, or for that matter a gun? Then I thought the least I could do was try to pull up far enough to get a license plate number. So I did just that. And just as I got up far enough, they sped away. So I went back to the person's home where I was staying and I got out and looked at my aunt's car. Sure enough, there was a very slight dent on the side door with a black streak running down the side. It was soon after that I began receiving threatening phone calls threatening me not to marry. They also seemed to know about my personal life. And then about a week later I finally received my first visit from the man I know as John Wallace. I cannot explain any of these experiences, but they are indeed startling and need to be explored further. Those experiences were more frightening than my abductions. The mystery helicopter's a MIB of the air. In an alarming development which seems to bring the MIB into the new age, quite a number of researchers have reportedly been repeatedly harassed by mysterious, unmarked, black helicopters which have kept them under surveillance both day and night. Bob Luca, an abductee himself who is married to Betty Andreas' son, a Connecticut woman whose experiences with aliens has been highly documented and is the subject of three best-selling books, including The Watchers by Raymond Fowler, which is just in current release. Over the course of the last few years, the Lucas say their home has been buzzed several times by these sinister-looking whirlybirds whose pilots try hard to keep their true identity a deeply hidden secret. They have also reportedly seen the choppers in the vicinity of their UFO contact points, and feel very strongly that there is a frightening aspect to the UFO enigma, and that the helicopters are part of this negativity. They also believe that the tragic death of one of Betty's sons is connected with this negative aspect of ufology, and it has taken a great deal of courage for them to go forward to tell the world of their encounters with beings from other worlds and dimensions. During many of the animal mutilations out west, helicopters have been seen making daily flybys as if keeping a close watch on their prospective prey. For many years, Riley Crabb was the director of the Borderland Sciences Research Foundation in Vista, California. Today, retired from his duties, Crabb lives comfortably in New Zealand, where he has moved partly due to the fact that he believes his UFO activities brought him undue harassment at the hands of the authorities in the United States. Recently, Crabb filed this special report with us which takes into consideration this new tactic by the UFO silencers to keep a watchful eye on UFO witnesses, abductees and contactees. It is a disturbing side of our story which has to be told. #1 Proof of the consuming interest of the US government in flying saucers is the sudden appearance of unmarked helicopters at the site of UFO activity, whether it be physical or mental. Of course, the appearance of the copters may be an illusion, created by advanced beings from other planets, other systems, but even this would still be proof of surveillance. In the book UFO Crash, Bill Stinman writes that unmarked helicopters overshadowed him when he was leaving a canyon after finishing his investigation of the Aztec, New Mexico UFO crash site. Contactee Bob Luca reports that unmarked helicopters of various makes kept his New England home under surveillance. He is husband of abductee Betty Andreessen. Photos of the copters shown to airport and other authorities drew a blank. No one would admit to owning them. And then there is the famous, or infamous, Cash Landrum case, in which over 20 unmarked helicopters accompanied the diamond-shaped, glowing UFO floating along at low altitude over a highway one night in Texas. Of course, no government employee or government agency will acknowledge the event. Now we have author Ed Conroy admitting to surveillance while he was writing his book on Whitley Strieber. According to the May, 1990 issue of UFO Universe, Ed had his first taste of unmarked helicopter surveillance on January 16, 1988. He was raking leaves in his mother's front yard in late afternoon when the unwelcome craft startled him with its presence overhead. He had already been involved for some time in writing the book on Strieber. The Whirlybird came down to treetop level, and to convince him that Big Brother was watching, a light was shone on him, scarcely an illusioner, for his mother ran out of the house to find out what was going on. There was a more spectacular appearance, and in quantity, in early March. This was while Ed Conroy was writing the book in a downtown office building on the 7th floor. He identified the craft as an unmarked Bell 47. Again a light was shone on him through the office window. But others appeared, a Chinook and a Huey, to buzz the building. All were unmarked but painted in different colors. More difficult to explain was the appearance of unmarked helicopters over his home or office when he was talking on the telephone about flying saucers. It appeared that these invisible agents were capable of reading his mind. The revelation of Ed Conroy's experience in 1988 reminded me of my own surveillance by unmarked helicopters in Southern California in 1970-71. At that time I was editing and publishing the Journal of Borderland Research from my home in Vista, about 40 miles north of San Diego. A major item of Borderland Research was the reality of flying saucers, and had been since reading Major Donald Kehoe's articles in True magazine in 1949, backed up by Frank Scully's impressive classic in 1950, Behind the Flying Saucers. This was in Honolulu, and the authorities were overwhelmed with reports of sightings and contacts by both civilian and military personnel. Mrs. Crabb and I moved to California in 1957, and I took over Borderland Sciences Research Associates in 1959. But it wasn't until June of 1970 that I got ambitious enough to set up a flying saucer detector. It's a simple device for reacting to magnetic anomalies in the vicinity. We did get false alarms from breezes coming through the open patio door and from passing hot rodders with souped-up ignition systems. It's a simple open circuit using a buzzer activated by the 115-volt house current. The switch is a metal loop about 6 inches in diameter, and a 4-inch Alnico bar magnet, with the south pole down. In our case the buzzer was mounted near the ceiling on the wall with the electrical current coming in there. The switch combination was mounted on the mop board close to the floor, so the suspension wire for the bar magnet was over 7 feet long. Our loop was a stainless steel strap or ribbon from an old percolator. Because of natural magnetic attraction between magnet and loop, the magnet had to be suspended several inches above the loop. A bare copper wire extension below the magnet assured contact with the loop when the magnet was pulled sideways. Then the buzzer warned of a closed circuit. There would be danger of shock from this circuit in a home with pets and/or children, so a battery-powered buzzer would be safer. Let me now quote from the July to August 1970 Journal of Borderland Research, June 24, 11:35 a.m. There was a loud, insistent buzz. Mrs. Crabb looked up from her desk in the study. The leaves on the garden trees were hanging still. She rushed outside to look up into an empty sky, 3D empty, at least. Your editor was occupied in the workshop, but I was thinking of the Men in Black at the time, planning a new flying saucer talk for the San Francisco Flying Saucer Club in September. How nice to have a physical reminder that we are not alone and unobserved. That was the first inkling I had that mental activities only could be read and acted upon by both good guys and bad guys from outer space, and even by special sensors in certain government agencies, possibly human or mechanical. The next morning, at 9:50 a.m. there was again a long, insistent buzz from our saucer seeker. This time I was at my typewriter framing a suitable letter to Associate Marion Nardil. She is a sensitive who had conscious contact with members of the Ashtar Command for years. Their self-chosen responsibility is to patrol the borders of the solar system and to challenge entry of invaders from other planets and systems. She had written to say that her father died suddenly of a massive stroke, a psychic attack. It was Andrew Hardy who took the time and trouble to transcribe the channeled messages from Ashtar, through his daughter, and send them to me for publication in the journal and thus share with the associates. This time there was plenty of activity overhead. A helicopter with U.S. Marine Corps markings made a low pass over our headquarters, and far above I could see the contrail of a jet plane at extreme altitude, but no circular, glowing disc of any kind.